I'm very pleased to welcome Sandra Geyer. Sandra is an all-round performer. As I've said in the introduction that I posted to the list, she's a soprano singer, a voiceover artist, a performing musician, and also broadcast radio presenter. So Sandra, I will hand over to you for today's presentation.
Thank you, Peter. And today's discussion, in inverted commas, is about the audition process. So how to approach it from beginning to end. So from the moment you read about whatever it is to then actually being in the audition room, and then the most important bit sort of after that, the gap between doing the audition and then either getting the job or coping with that rejection letter or hearing nothing, which in itself is rejection by just lack of contact. So that's what I'm going to cover today. And this assumes that you've got everything else in place. So you're happy with your representation, whether you're representing yourself or you have agency representation, whatever size that is, or you've got management or a combination of the above. You've got all your promotional material, your internet presence, your showreels, video or CDs or whatever else, your headshot, your media kit, all those things that I went into a lot of detail in when I was on this call last time. So any questions about that, obviously, fair enough. But what I'm going to talk about assumes that you have all that in place, and I'm just focusing on getting the auditions, getting the job or not getting the job. So we start off with looking at the audition. So you see the ad or whatever it is, and you've got the brief in front of you. So you have a number of choices. You either apply for the audition or you don't. And there are reasons why you may not choose to undertake the audition. So the first thing you would do is actually a certain amount of research around whatever this is. So if it's, you know, an acting role, a music role, whatever it is, you would do your research. Are you suitable for this that's come in front of you? Because if you're not, then there's not a lot of point in doing the audition unless you have reasons of strategy, and I'll come back to that later. So you look at your suitability. If you're not suitable, self-disqualification is the obvious route. If you are suitable, then you look at the likelihood of you getting this job. And there are a certain number of factors in there. So I'll take disability out of the equation for a second, because there are various productions that have either you as a disabled artist in it, or you're focusing on just one aspect. So let's say you're in a studio and you're sitting down doing the job and it's literally an audio recording that will go out. Disability is less of a factor in the finished product. I'm not talking about transportation or getting there or any of that, but I'm talking about the end product. So you've got the audition. You're deciding to take it on because you're not only suitable for the job, but you know that you would be good at the job, because sometimes you're suitable for something, but you just don't have the skill level. So you have to do your own analysis and assessment of the situation before you just go for something. So suitability is a big factor. The numbers of people applying for this job is another factor. And that will depend on how many outlets this job is being seen on. So if something is being seen on Twitter, as a case in point, and you know how many viewers are on there, so let's say there are 1,000 people who could potentially see this job, you know that a minimum of 1,000 other people are going to be seeing this. So your odds are within that group. If, for the sake of argument, you've got representation and it's a fairly small agency, and you know that you're one of 10 people who will be put up for this job, then your odds of getting it are higher than that Twitter job of 1,000 people. So you've got to make those kinds of judgments. It's not only suitability, but the numbers up for it. And then the narrower the brief, the lower the numbers. So if you've got a brief of a job that is 16 years old to 99 years old, that's quite a wide brief. So the numbers seeing it will be higher. And then looking at the different outlets. So if you've got something that's on Twitter and it's on Spotlight and it's on half a dozen outlets, then you know that the odds of getting that job are very, very slim. But if it's a narrow brief, as in 25 to 30, you know, must be fluent French speaker or various other things, the brief is much narrower and the people who are likely to have those same skills decreases. So your odds of getting it, especially if you are good at what you do and you know you are good at what you do, increase. There's a lot of factors in there as to whether you'll get the job or not. It's not just about being good at it, but the amount of other people who are also good at it being in front of that casting team. And also, you know, we're in the land of the self-tape and the Zoom audition and all those kinds of things. And just sometimes being the first person that they see is enough to create the best impression for you to, if not succeed at that audition, but get another job later on. So sometimes it's about booking the room rather than booking the job. There are various jobs I've had where I've got them, but not because of the audition I initially did. So it's about seeding sometimes. And that comes back to the strategy I said earlier, where you might go for a job that you're not especially suitable for, but you want to be seen by a certain person and you know that that casting member of the team will be at this audition. So for the sake of argument, let's say that, you know, a casting team member from Game of Thrones is at this audition and you know that you're not wholly suitable for it, but you're good enough to be seen so that you get into the room, whether it's a Zoom room or in-person room or whatever, and you do an amazing audition, you are then remembered by that casting team and the seed is sown for something later. So that is another thing to bear in mind, so that when you don't get a job, there are various reasons as to why you might not get the job. You might just have been not that good on the day, or you might not be as suitable as you think you are, because you have to get into a casting frame of mind. And especially when you're able to record your audition, especially in a self-tape situation, you're able to listen back, get someone else to watch it if it's a video, and literally audition yourself. So when you are in a situation where you've had the audition and you either get a rejection by the, we'd like to thank you for your time, unfortunately you didn't get the job, or you just don't hear back. And you'll know you didn't hear back because you'll pay attention to the recording dates or the touring dates or whatever it is. You know, the first fitting is the 1st of January. It's the 3rd of January. You haven't heard anything. You know, you haven't got the job. Sometimes casting teams will not know what they want first off. They just know what they don't want when they see what they don't want, and then they narrow it down from there. And you can tell that sometimes when you've got a wide brief, the 16 to 99s that I mentioned earlier. I rarely give them the time of day now because I know what the odds are. Sometimes things change. So a write-up will be one particular brief, and then the more people they see, the narrower the brief becomes, and they decided, actually, we don't really want this anymore. Even though they'll still see you at times, they'll automatically dismiss you because you don't fulfill the criteria they want to look at. When you're able to, and this is more pertinent when you have representation than if you're just doing this on your own, get feedback about why they didn't go with you, because that's a useful thing to have. You know, if you know that you didn't get the job because you weren't the right fit or the right look or the right voice type or the right instrument or instrument register or whatever else, then you can go away and do something about that. You know, whether that's apply for different work or hone up your skill level, something like that. Another thing you can do is if you don't hear back and you know it's a production, you can actually go and see it. And in the world we're in at the moment, that is a lot easier than it might have been. So TV, radio, Zoom, and all of that. There's a production out or an ad, you didn't get the job, you can see it, you know, listen to it and get someone else to look at it if it's a TV thing, to then find out what the person who did get it has that you don't. And it might be something like skill, which is unlikely if you're listening to this presentation, because you're all pretty good at what you do, she says in hope. Sometimes it might be the right bearing, as in confidence and competence. So sometimes you'll go into an audition and you know what you're doing, but the stress of the situation gets to you and either you don't perform as well as you want to, or you do perform as well as you want to. But in the before and after, as in there might be a post-audition interview sort of thing, just tell me about yourself. What do you do? Or what do you like to eat? And all of that, you come across as twitchy and nervy. And do you remember, all of it is an audition, not just the song or piece you produce, but from the moment that the casting team sees you, not just in person, but you know, your headshot and all the other things that I talked about onwards is an audition. So it's not just what you can do, but how good or bad you are to work with. That's another reason why some people may or may not get the job and just not know, because they're not as aware of themselves as they might be. So it's important to have your confidence and competence. Competence is in what you do and how you portray yourself in front of others, because you don't get a second chance to make a first impression, which I'm sure you already know. I'm going to come back to nerves in a mo, because that's an important weapon in your arsenal that you may or may not be using at the moment. When I talk about nerves, I mean the adrenaline rush. I don't mean that kind of weird, almost numbing feeling you might get that makes you think you can't do anything and you'll never do anything well ever again. That's something else. I'm talking about the excitement of coming up to do a job. And we'll call the audition a job for the sake of argument, because it is a performance. You know, regardless of what you have to do in it, it's a performance like any other. And you have the knowledge that you have done a lot of performing before. So you have this in front of you, like any other thing that you've done before, and you'll do it again. You'll do it again well. And with the confidence aspect, there's no other way around it but just faking it till you make it. So inside yourself, you're gibbering slightly maybe, but on the outside, you come across as different. And you can turn that into an aspect of the performance, as in, you know, a different persona or something, if necessary. It shouldn't be, because if you're good at what you're doing and you've assessed the situation as far as you can, and you've analyzed it and you've rehearsed and you've got ready for this, then there really isn't anything to worry about. So the worrying that you're doing up to a point is irrational. So you basically acknowledge that what you're worrying about is just psychological stuff, and that the thing in front of you is something that will happen again. It's something you've done well before. You'll do it well again. These people in front of you have a job to do. You have your own job to do. Your only job is just making them feel like they're in the presence of someone absolutely amazing. And that's yourself. So you go in and you assert the confidence, whether you have confidence or not. You assert your confidence and make sure that they experience nothing short of extraordinary from you. Because I'll bring disability back into it for a moment. You might be the only disabled candidate for this audition, assuming it's not a disability-focused role. So you might be the first and last representative of disability and of your disability that they will see. So it's got to be a positive experience for them, rather than, well, this disabled person doesn't really know what they're doing, or what do you expect, they're disabled. You don't want that. And you don't want them having second thoughts before they see another disabled person for this role or for something else. So that, oh, well, we had someone else last week. That was just not good. And make sure that your orientation is on point. By orientation, I mean orientation in relation to the people in the room. So there's nothing more embarrassing, and I've been there, you know, going into the room and having the panel in front of you, but not necessarily knowing they're in front of you. And then you're giving the performance of your life to the wall off to the left. I've done that nearly. So you don't want that. I tend to rely on an accompanist, you know, am I facing the right way sort of thing. I remember a few times I've tricked panelists into speaking by, you know, asking what the weather is like, whatever, not because I know or I even care about it, but I need to know where they are in the room in relation to me so I know that I'm facing the right way. Confidence and competence, because it all adds up to their overall experience of you as a performer, you know, when you come in and when you leave. Zoom is slightly messy because you need to make sure that the angles of the screen reflect you best and the lighting reflects you best. And don't be afraid to ask the person at the other end, you know, can you see my face and neck and everything? You know, there's been times where I've thought I've been saying something really serious and profound and all they've got is my forehead. And the sighted people are easily distracted by these things. They just are, you know, vision is their dominant sense. So make sure your confidence and competence are up to scratch in all these things. You know, make sure that you are dressed well, or dressed for the part anyway, and that you look good, you know, hair, makeup, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, it all needs to be, it all needs to reflect your competence. So if you're a great performer, you need to look like you are, not that you've just fallen out of a car and so on. And I know that's easier said than done, especially if you don't have any sighted friends or family to look to for some of this stuff. And that's where representation can sometimes come in handy, because they'll know things you don't, or know people you can get hold of at a moment's notice to just help you with the hair and the makeup and things, or get a reader if you need that, you know, in play, because you don't want to turn up to an audition where it looks like you haven't prepared yourself properly. So confidence and competence are key aspects of this. So I'm going to pretend then that you've done everything you should be. You've absolutely smashed the audition and you still didn't get the job, even though you are the most suitable person and candidate for it. I'll come back to the idea of the feedback, because that is one of the most useful things you can have in order to learn from that previous encounter to then take it forward into the next one. Sometimes it isn't useful. I had feedback once where they said, actually, we loved your audition, but we went in a different direction. Well, you can't really do much with that. You know, so it was a role where I auditioned as an adult and then they went with a teenager. You know, I can't teenage myself, but it's useful information. And I didn't waste time thinking about what I could have done differently. I couldn't have done anything differently. I know that. And sometimes that's enough to sort out your own peace of mind about these things. Another aspect of rejection is, as I said, that kind of turning things over in your mind as to what you could have done differently, even sometimes, you know, you couldn't have. The one thing I would say that has been certainly the most helpful for me is knowing that there are plenty more fish in the sea, because there are. There's a whole volume of jobs that they will come. Jobs come and go, and not to set too much store by one job. And depending on where you find your work, you'll be aware of the volume of jobs that come through. And also analyzing your own statistics in terms of what they call bookability. So I'll share my own odds with you. And they differ in terms of where I get the job as to whether I get it, because I represent myself and I have agency representation. So when I represent myself, this doesn't apply to singing, because most of the time with singing, I get asked to do things. I'm just sticking with the stuff I audition for. My odds are a mixture. They average out at 5 to 1, as in 5 auditions, I get one job. But sometimes it's 10 to 1, sometimes even 15 to 1. When my agent puts me up for jobs, they average out at 3 to 1. So 3 auditions, 1 job. A lot of the time it's 2 to 1, and sometimes it's 1 to 1. So audition, job, audition, job, audition, job. And that's the best place to be with these things. But sometimes it's about finding out why that is. So for me, I know that when I update my credits, when I have my home studio sorted and all those things, that my bookability goes up. So there's fair few television stuff come out recently that I've been in. I was in the J.K. Rowling Christmas Pig, that's on Audible, and various other high profile things. And when those start to be published, my bookability goes up, because no one likes to be first to the party. You know, people aren't going to book you if you've never done anything. They want some proof that you are actually good at what you do, rather than just either saying I'm good at what I do, or the video that proves you are good at what you do. They like being associated with positive outcomes and high profile situations, you know, so that they can increase that by association. And I spoke a little bit about that last time. So finally, I'll come back to the nerves of the situations, because I didn't touch much on nerves. I spoke about the adrenaline based nerves, as in I'm revved up to do this, let's do this. If your nerves are based on anxiety, however rational or irrational it is, because rationality has nothing to do with it sometimes, you know, I can intellectually know every aspect of a venue, and I'll still be scared that I will crash into the microphone and hit my face with it, even though that's completely irrational, because I know my mic stand and I know that there's gaffer tape there and all the rest of it. It's an irrational fear. I'm still frightened of it. What you can do, and it's underrated, is different types of breathing exercises to invoke the parasympathetic nervous system. You've got the sympathetic nervous system, the fight, flight, freeze, and all the rest of it, and the parasympathetic system that induces a calm state. So 5-5-5 is a nice one. So you breathe in for 5, you hold for 5, and you breathe out for 5. The key aspect of how to induce the parasympathetic nervous system is breathing out longer than you breathe in. So if you breathe in for 5, you might breathe out for 6, or literally slow down the count. So it's still 5-5-5 or 7-11. I mean, there's loads of them on YouTube, so I'm not going to go into too much detail about it, but just breathing out longer than you breathe in. And then not overdoing it so that you're in a state of falling asleep, because then you won't be able to perform terribly well. But just turning off that flight, fight or freeze response, or reducing it. And sometimes you will have a lot of nervous energy and you can plow that into the performance you're about to give. And it's easier when you've done a fair bit of practice. So putting yourself into those situations by auditioning a lot or doing a lot of jobs, because you'll perform and you'll have nerves like that up to a point sometimes, especially if you're in a new situation. So you haven't performed in a certain way for a long time, things like that. But it's about knowing yourself and knowing the job, knowing the situation you're getting into, and evaluating the situation as best you possibly can and get as many facts as possible. And that's it. So if there's any
questions. Fascinating. Yeah, well, I was going to say, one thing is that you work across so many, you know, formats, genre. Do you find any differences between those? Like, this is a singing audition, this is an acting audition. Are there sort of different approaches to, or, you know, contexts for those?
Well, you still do the same things. You still research every aspect of it. You still, if you have the time, I didn't go into same day auditions, which are a bit of a faff. You don't have the time to do loads of rehearsing. And the good bit about that is that you don't spend too much time worrying. You don't have the time. You just got to get on with it. But there's no real difference in terms of how you analyze it, and how you do your research, and how you get your confidence and competence in the right setting, whether you're singing or acting or dancing, which I don't do. And it's a Zoom audition, you've still got to make sure the screen is the right angle. So in terms of the logistics side, there isn't a huge amount of difference. I know within myself, I take the singing side a lot more personally than I do with acting. I've only been doing that 5 minutes. whether I get a job there or don't get a job, I don't lose a huge amount of sleep. But with singing, because I've devoted like nearly my whole working life to it, I take it very personally, you know, and I find it harder to analyze a situation. So that gets more subjective, I suppose, the more involved you are emotionally. And you could argue that we are involved emotionally in what we do. You know, it's an act of love, it's art, it's all this stuff. It's not doing filing, you know, we do it because we love it. You know, if I dare to complain about any of this, you know, to my family or anything, they're like, you chose this. And I'm like, yeah, thanks for nothing. But yeah, I think that's the only real difference, is that my lack of emotional involvement sometimes in acting. When if it's an audition that involves a lot of time and energy, I went up for a pregnant role last year that I didn't get, and I'm not that sorry I didn't, but anyway, I spent ages researching babies and all sorts and the development at 12 weeks and blah 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 blah. So the more time and energy you put into it, the harder it is to divorce yourself from it after the fact. And that's true whether it's an acting, a singing, a voiceover, a radio, whatever it is. But it's something that must be done, otherwise you'll go crazy. Like I use the reality TV shows as a case in point. You'll have someone blethering on there that they've spent a whole year on one song, and then, you know, the panel will say that they haven't got whatever it was, and then they're crying in the lift like their life is over, you know. Whereas if they looked at it with a plenty more fish in the sea attitude and dust themselves off and get back on the horsey, then they wouldn't necessarily feel that way. You know, there are lots of jobs. It's easier to think about just how many jobs there are when your work outlet is producing those ads multiple times per day. So I can, you know, they're pinging and dinging and whatever else. So I know more will come. You know, if I haven't got this one, there's more out there.
What do you do about sight reading? Do you get to an interview, you know, to an audition, and, you know, they can't just stick a script in front of you or a piece of music in front of you?
You negotiate seeing it ahead of the time.
Okay, yeah.
And you definitely use the disabled card. That tends to be easier with representation than without, but it's still doable. I mean, I was doing that the other week where I had a script and they sent it through to me, but they had various bits in bold and it didn't necessarily come through for me properly. I was able to get a different setting on Jaws in the end, and it was able to read it. But I like mine in Braille. I don't really like them sitting there on the computer like that. Braille is easier to memorize. But if you've sold yourself correctly, they will accommodate you. So if you pitch your disability in terms of, I'm the best person for this job, and you just don't know it yet, I mean, without saying that specifically, they'll accommodate your needs. You know, when in my cover letters, sometimes, you know, I'll say something like, you know, as a blind person, my television work has been rather niche and includes this, this, and this, and my stuff in radio, stage, and screen has benefited thus far because of my disability, and I can do this and that. I mean, I can have a script on my lap and my face can be straight ahead. A sighted person wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah, it's a thing. I mean, like,
you get it ahead of time as possible.
It's a thing that I can kind of worry about with playing jazz, for example, because you would think, you know, if you're playing jazz, if you're playing standards, you know, you know the material, you can improvise. But quite often with a pickup gig, people are going to use charts. People are going to have their own particular way of doing it, and the standard routine is that you turn up and you do the gig, so you would think there would be no reading involved in a jazz gig, but there actually might be. I mean, that's, you know, that's even without,
I know
there
what
are
you mean.
Arrangements.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. We're about to go on stage. Here's this bit of paper. All right, mate.
Yes.
But you will have liaised with whoever it is before turning up. You don't just
yeah.
You know, you're not on lastminutepianist.com.
No,
you're not. So you will have had contact with the booker prior, and then that's the conversation you have with them. And there are various like tabs and sheets on the internet, and you ask them for the sheet in the format that you need. So if it's XML, then you can put it into whatever software you've got. I mean, I'm riffing here because I don't know which software you use to get one thing into another thing. So me, I'm a Braille music doodah.
Yeah, so I'm not really a Braillist. I do most things by ear, really. And, you know, so reading would be Jaws and stuff. But
yeah, so they must have music, you know, a sheet that would say literally B, you know, C7.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 If they could send me that, then that'd be fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And presumably you have a 10-minute rehearsal with whoever it is beforehand, or do you literally just, let's just go, you know, let the music do the talking.
Go for it, that's right, yeah.
Right, okay. What fun.
This might be sort of slightly more on the sort of pre-audition stage, but I'm interested in where you get your auditions from. Do you have multiple sources, streams for that? So what would those be?
Well, let me ask you what yours are, because mine are kind of multidisciplinary, as it were.
Okay, well, I went on Star Now, and I think you suggested in your previous talk that was possibly not the best thing to go on. I think you mentioned Spotlight today as being a better source. Yeah. So that was a useful tip, which I haven't acted on yet.
It's not necessarily a better source for jobs, although lots of jobs come through on Spotlight. Spotlight is an international directory for performers. So that's not just singers and actors, but, you know, people who work in, you know, I was going to say combat, but, you know, like stunt doubles and just any kind of performer, models, everything. And various acting jobs will come through there, various singing things, you know, acting with, singing in, you know, I've been in like musicals and operas and so on and so forth. Not through them, but that's the kind of thing that might appear on there sometimes. And, you know, I'm thinking as to whether you've done any session work yourself, like orchestra, like session orchestra and all this stuff.
No, I don't do that. Nothing in theatres.
Is that at the moment, you've chosen not to,
I've never really thought about it. I've mostly been, you know, clubs, pubs, festivals, kind of thing. Never particularly occurred to me to do that. I think of theatre as reading jobs, although, you know, clearly there are ways around it, as you say, if you can get the stuff. If you could get the material prior to the audition and prior to the performance, obviously.
Yeah, and if you know it to start with, like,
I've just never been interested in doing it.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, for like musicals and other things where the material, it won't really change that much. So if you're told the audition is, I don't know, Don't Cry For Me or something, you know, you'll know it anyway.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, also, just very recently, actually, I joined a couple. I live sort of 30 miles out of London, so I do quite a lot of work in Kent where I live, and I work in London as well. But I don't work in London as much as I would like to, and I've been on a lot of Facebook groups in Kent. So, you know, Thanet Jazz, Canterbury Jazz, whatever. And just recently got onto a couple of London Facebook groups, which it hadn't even entered my head to do. And there's a lot of good stuff on there. There's stuff that I can, you know, readily and happily apply for. So that's quite a good new information stream for me. There's a specific jazz group, but there's also a wider sort of London music Facebook group. So those are, I think, going to be, you know, I'm at the moment researching those. I'm looking at the competition. You know, when somebody puts up a job, say somebody was looking for a jazz trio for to open a bar in central London. So I think about, you know, 20 people applied for that. And of course, they all sent in YouTubes and websites and stuff. So I spent quite a bit of time just checking out the YouTubes and websites to see, you know, what's the competition like? How do people go about doing this? And yeah, I think that's going to come in handy.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm taking it for granted that people have their YouTubery and website-erific stuff up. Do I take it that you don't have that yet?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah,
that's all in place. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and with depending on the caliber of job, you know, things can be negotiated, like transport and remote stuff and all these kinds of things. So I think back to, you know, certain recordings I've done this year, there was at least one where everyone else was in studio in London and I did it remotely. My agent was able to negotiate that for me. You know, I was fresh out of hospital actually and wasn't in the mood for any work. But she was like, well, can you bring yourself to do this? Like, well, yeah, fine. But so before people start thinking about, and I'm saying this in, you know, the recording and all that, people listening to it, whatever, before people think about, well, I can't do this or that, you know, how am I going to get there? You know, we live in quite a flexible time now where you have Zoom options and recording options, especially for auditions. With the actual job, then you can negotiate expenses and stuff like that. You know, I don't know. I know how commercials work. You do have to get there under your own steam, but definitely for actual TV programs, and by that I mean dramas and comedies and stuff rather than the reality telly or whatever. With dramas and comedies and so on, they will provide transport for you.
Do you get a sense with people who you're auditioning for as to how hung up on the disability aspect they are? You know, what I find is that there are some people, I think about it a lot these days, you know, the social aspects of it. There's a sort of thing that my wife and I, who we sometimes perform as a duo, we talk about this thing called the bloke factor. And, you know, yeah, you do know. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, and you just get that sense of whether, am I the sort of guy you would clap on the back and go out for a pint with? And quite often my sense is that, you know, however blokey I can be, and, you know, I can be pretty blokey, and you know, and if I sense that in somebody, I'll go on the attack quite definitely, you know, to combat it. But I don't know, sometimes you do get that sense, or, you know, sometimes I might have the sense that, you know, say there's somebody who has worked with me and worked with another guitarist, and they might give a job to that guitarist. And I might think that I deserve that job more than he did. And I might just have a little sense of, I think this is disability kicking in because it's just easier to work with that guy than it is to work with me.
And is it easier because of the logistics of working with you, as in,
well,
getting you ferried to the job, or are you thinking about disability prejudice-y? Whatever.
Both. And I mean, actually, you know, on that subject of prejudice, it is standard format in banned adverts to say must have own gear, own transport. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's parroted. People don't even think about what they're saying. It's like what they're saying is, I don't want you to be any work for me.
Yeah. All I can say about that is the higher the caliber of the job, the less kind of caper you'll find with that.
Yeah.
So it's about the kind of work and the kind of, I don't want to come across like too speakery, but there's the phrase where your network is your net worth. And if you're performing with people who don't necessarily plan ahead properly or just kind of turn up and role? Because I mean, I've worked with jazz musicians myself and haven't really come across that, you know, very, very organized and able to do the sight reading and all the rest of it. You know, there's jazz musicians without necessarily a detrimentally spontaneous attitude. And yep. So I think you need to work out where you're applying for work. You know, if you're applying for work on social media, then anything goes. It's very different from jobs where it says underneath, you know, this is paid according to equity or according to union, this, that, and the other. If a job is abiding by various regulations, then they're not allowed to behave like that. You know, and as for like disability prejudice, I may be the wrong person to ask because a lot of the roles I apply for are blind people roles. So all the stuff I've been in on telly is blind woman this, blind woman that.
But what about the singing jobs, the soprano jobs?
They tend to ask for me, or if they haven't necessarily asked for me. And there's been a couple of things I've been in where the role wasn't blind to start with and they just rewrote it so it was.
Oh, okay.
So I remember there was a musical I was in called Orpheus the Mythical. And it was on in 2018 in the Other Palace Theatre. And I was in it then, and I was also in it a few years ago. But when it was on originally, my role was a sighted person, and there was a lot of running around and all sorts of things, and it was completely rewritten.
Brilliant. So
that's what I'm saying to you.
That's the compliment. When you,
yeah, it is, but I'm saying that the if a team wants to work with you, they will make it work. Do you see?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I had a question about nerves. Yeah. I was interested in what you were saying about, I mean, the breathing's great when you're preparing, but
you practice it. You practice it when you don't need it. You're not like, you know, at the height of panic, and you're like, I need to do my breathing and I don't know how to do this. You practice it, you know, when you're not in war. You know, the guys in, you know, in the army and stuff learn how to field strip their guns and stuff. They don't do that when they're in the middle of a pitched battle. They learn how to do it when the nice, cozy training ground.
Sure.
So
I mean,
that's how you do that. You know, you do it in your sitting room or your bedroom, and you learn how to do this so that you can do it on all.
Oh, you're still there. You dropped out.
Autopilot. Calm. Oh. No, I did. Oh, it's saying my internet connection is unstable. So how much of that actually came through?
I think it just picked up when you said autopilot, but
yeah,
there was a long gap.
What I was saying was that you practice it, you know, in a relaxed environment and in familiar environments. So you're at home, your kitchen, bedroom, sitting room, whatever, and you practice it when you're relaxed, and so that you can get it to a point where you can just flip it and be autopilot. So you're in a panic situation and you can just get calm.
That does sound really effective. I was thinking, I mean, I'm not a performer in general. That's not what I do most of the time, but I have recently, I've been in a world music group. So I've done gigs, and what I find happens sometimes is that out of the blue, I will suddenly lose the feeling that I'm in control and I know what I'm doing, even though I may have practiced the thing 100 times. And I don't know whether that's something you even have experienced, or whether you have any techniques, or if it's simply the fact that I just don't do it all the time. That's not my thing. But I'd be curious to know if that's ever happened to you and David for that matter, and how you might approach it.
Yeah, I mean, when you say lose control, like, do you blank? Because I've had that where what's going to come out of my mouth next. So I've just...
It could be blanking, or it could be the actual physical control. For example, I play flute, and the feeling that all of a sudden your fingers are simply not obeying you. They're not doing what you expect them to do. And as I say, no matter how familiar you are with the piece and you practiced it 100 times, but it suddenly, yeah, it just suddenly
comes. But then it's a stressful situation and you get all sweaty. Yeah, I've had that exactly on the piano, and yeah, and your fingers just do a weird dance thing. And some of exactly that is down to the adrenaline of the situation, is that I'm revved up to do this thing. And so it's sending more energy to your fingers than they actually need when you're trying to do this very precise, delicate maneuver. And then, I don't know, you might spasm or jump or something where you didn't mean to, but there's just so much fizz and whiz energy going around because you might not have practiced kind of channeling it and taming it, taming the beast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I find slightly different things according to whether I'm playing a written thing like a fingerstyle arrangement, or if I'm improvising. And of course, it's easier if you're improvising because you just play less.
Yeah, no one knows what's coming up.
Play a little easier. With the fingerstyles, I must admit, I've over the years I've gravitated more to improvising because of it being easier to do that on the written stuff. I think how much you're doing, it does make a difference, because in the course of performing, you know, of years of performing, I think you do get to the point where if you lose it, you it's the question of how quickly you can recover it again. And I do find
all those things.
I can recover better. When I was first playing, if I made a mistake, it could screw me up for quite a long time. And now it only screws me up for a moment, and it usually comes back again. Yeah, it's kind of a skill in itself, really. And maybe you just have to do it so often that you don't get that rush of fear that stops you doing it, stops you getting back on. But you may be at that state anyway, Peter, that you're recovering fast enough for it not to really make everything fall apart anyway.
Yeah, it varies, but yeah.
Yeah. You just got to have, you know, part of your mind that's in a way the conductor, like, okay, this is where we're at now, and this is the strategy that's going forward. Yeah, the part that's gibbering away going, oh no, I've messed up, and everyone's looking at me where they probably haven't noticed. And yeah, okay, this is what we're doing now.
There is
I was going to say it's even reassuring to hear that that's happened to you, because you come across as so confident. And I guess just knowing that we're not the only ones, I guess, is good too.
The thing with guitar, improvising on guitar, I always wonder what it would be like to be able to see the fretboard, because there are times when, you know, you just have a little, hey, I could try this, and you shoot up an arpeggio or a scale or whatever, and then you think, oh, hey, where did that get me to on the neck? And sometimes I have to shoot back to the bottom of the neck to get myself to remind myself where I am, and then work back up. And that's a kind of
very interesting. So when you say you play by ear, then you don't have perfect pitch or relative pitch where you're like, this is where I am.
Well, it's kind of what are the edges of your relative pitch, you know? Or in fact, it's not so much to do with the pitch as it's a slight insecurity about which note I'm playing. So I mean, okay, if I'm in an arpeggio, I know where I am, but I might sometimes just play a little phrase that occurs to me, and I execute the phrase fine because my fingers know where to go to make the sound that I'm hearing, but I might not have clocked which actual exact note I was playing at the end of, you know, which fret I was on at the end of that, which is, you know, as I say, it's a kind of failure of technique, in that ideally you should always know exactly what note you're fingering whenever you're fingering, but sometimes you just have a little inspiration.
Moments of inspiration. Yeah. And okay, well, what is that? I mean, that's where
kind
where
of am
taping,
I?
Taping yourself, you know, recording yourself comes in, so you can capture those moments and then teach yourself whatever it was. Because, you know, I've played the guitar a long time ago, and it's not as difficult as the violin's fretboard, because there's no frets, there's just neck. So you really have to get to. But what I was going to say was, before I launched into that tangent, was that the best musicians don't actually look at it, just as they don't look at the piano, because looking at it slows them down. So they will be as intuitive as you are in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember hearing that Mark Knopfler had a guitar made specially with no fret markers on it.
no markers or no frets. It wasn't a fretless.
No dots, no pearly dots to show which fret you're on. So it was a fretted guitar. Oh, you do get fretless guitars now. It's quite a thing. I think Fortuny plays one.
It's easier on the fingers, because then you only have one thing digging into your hand as opposed to a fret and a string.
Yeah, I guess so.
And then the notes are less likely to be duffers, you know, because you don't have to get bang in the middle of the fret, so it rings.
No.
so I can see the good points and bad points for that. But I think in terms of like auditioning and doing jobs and all of that sort of thing, it's about rehearsing enough so that you know where you are with everything. And I appreciate that with the same day audition or with a 24-hour audition, that's harder to do than if you had 3 days or a week. But it's still like, if you put your mind to it, and then that might feed into whether you decide whether to do whatever it is. You know, there's a talk I went to ages ago, and this performer was dyslexic, and she said she spent, I don't know, 16 to 24 hours preparing for an audition. And I just filling my sides, and I thought, you clearly don't get many same day auditions then. But then she turned around and said, I'd never do any same day auditions. I'm like, right, okay, that's interesting. Because I know my agent sends me various things and a day's notice. And gotta like it or not. You know, actually, I just don't have the time for this, or I don't have enough time. I remember one I had to, it was in French, and I had to translate it myself and do the audition and stuff. And you know, I had a choice in front of me. I could either, you know, complain about having this much stuff to do, or I could say, actually, I'm not doing that. You know, I've got more. I'm not doing it. You know, there's one recently that was a 13-year-old role put me up for it. And I know why put me up for it, because she has a certain amount of blind people on her books. You know, it's a blind role, blind, here we go. I've got more self-respect to put myself in that situation. So you don't have to say yes to everything, is my point.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
No. You carry on. If you've still got anything more questions, I was going to say we probably need to wind it up quite soon. But if you've got any more points, please go ahead.
I was just interested in the difference in your success rate when you're going for things yourself and when your agent is going for things. And I guess I wasn't that surprised by that. But I'm just wondering, when the agent goes for things, would they be involved in kind of a certain amount of negotiating up front anyway, you know, saying, you know, that this person is, you know, kind of arguing your case in a way that kind of comes better from an agent than it does for an individual?
They don't really need to, because like the agency I'm with is an agent for disabled performers. People wouldn't bother going to her if they don't want a disabled person. That's all she does. So she doesn't need to argue for me, oh, she's blind, but she's good at these things. You know, if they're looking for somebody, like a lot of the time it's like a pan disability role. So any disabled person will fit. It's just a question of whether you fit what they need. But one of the reasons why the odds of me getting whatever it is are higher is because there's only a certain amount of people that will be put up for the job. So you're getting down to the 20s or 10s or even lower, you know, if you're looking at a visually impaired role. Even if you're not, if you're looking at a PAN disability role, then you're looking at hundreds. But hundreds aren't thousands. You know, sometimes I put myself up for things that have thousands of people potentially looking at it. That's one thing. Another thing is the brief is narrower. So the 16 to 99s I mentioned, I don't really do them, but I won't find that kind of brief on her website. And another thing is I spend a lot of time on suitability analysis. And sometimes when I don't have all the facts, I will ask for more from her. You know, it's where I'm putting stuff up and putting myself up for things. I don't necessarily have the ear of the person directing the whole thing. You know, I've got to base my decision on the advert as opposed to stuff behind the scenes. There was one that, you know, I'm singing in and it's a TV advert for Motability and so on and so forth. And I, at the time, wasn't going to go for it because it advertised a male in the blind role. And I basically said at the time, what should put me up for this for? I'm not a man. And I said to her, you know, I'm not going to put myself up for this. You know, it's a man and I'm not, you know, I didn't say I'm not wasting my time, but she said, no, go for it because they've changed their mind now. And I'm like, oh, okay. So there are different aspects to this, but that the 2-to-1, 1-to-1, you know, there's been things where I've been asked for specifically through my agency. Because they're able to spend time extolling your virtues. You know, I won't even say you're arguing your case because that suggests that they don't want you and you have to make the effort to make sure.
Yeah, sorry, that was a bad choice.
That's the case when, you know, it's an unsolicited thing and you have to really pitch like you've never pitched before. But when you're in a situation where it's highly targeted, so for example, like myself, I'm with an agency that specializes in disabled performers. So people looking at that agency want somebody disabled of some description. If they didn't, then they wouldn't go there in the first place. Another thing is sometimes that's the only agency in play. Now, for that particular job, I think there were at least four or five other agencies. So the odds of me getting it were lower than I thought they were. And I still got it. But sometimes it will be a case of that's the only agency, in which case it'll be the hundreds or tens or less. And then when it's that one agency, sometimes it won't be that many people put up for it. So there was a job I got where I was narrating for Tate Modern, the art gallery, and there were two people up for it, myself and somebody else. I didn't get that particular one, but I got the next one. So the point is there was a 50-50 chance of me getting it as opposed to a much lower. So that's the kind of analysis you need to be making when you decide to go for something, you know, and how much time and energy you're spending on it and not getting too attached to certain details like the finance, you know, so that you're not, in other words, mourning, not getting the 20,000 quid, you know, if you're not focused on that, if you're just focused on auditioning for whatever it is and looking at other aspects of it and whether you're able to do it and whether you're suitable for it and good enough for it and whether you're better than everyone else involved, and you can make that assessment based on the law of averages, you know, how likely is it that you are better than everyone else there? Because that's the point. A lot of the time, assuming you're auditioning for something where you don't have to look a certain way or bear yourself in a certain way.
Great. So for those who are listening to this as a recording, you'll have gathered this was a very small and select group, but I want to thank Sandra very much because there was a wealth of experience and good ideas in there. So yeah. Many, many thanks, Sandra.